So here's the setup. It's 207 BC, southern Italy, dawn. A Roman cavalry patrol rides up to a Carthaginian camp and throws something over the wall.
A human head.
The soldiers in the camp bring it to their general. He's been in Italy for 11 years. He hasn't seen his brother in all that time. He picks up the head and he recognizes the face.
It's Hasdrubal, his younger brother. The reinforcements he'd been waiting for over a decade, were never coming.
And Creasy writes one of the saddest sentences in the entire book. In the agony of his heart, the great Carthaginian groaned aloud that he recognized his country's destiny.
Not, I see the destiny of Carthage, which is the version people always misquote. He groaned. He didn't make a speech. He made a sound.
And Creasy follows it with a Latin quote from Horace. Occidit, occidit, spes omnes et fortuna nostri nominis, Hasdrubale interemto. All hope and fortune of our name has perished, perished, with Hasdrubal slain.
That double occidit, perished, perished, like a heartbeat stopping.
And here's the thing, Creasy, who loves Rome, who is writing a book about Western civilization winning, actually condemns the Romans for this. He calls it the true spirit of that savage brutality which deformed the Roman national character.
When a Victorian imperialist looks at your conduct and says, that's a bit much, you've gone too far.
So, welcome to BS Killer Book Autopsy Season 2, Dead Authors Club. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. We read books by dead authors, so you don't have to. 15 Decisive Battles of the World by Sir Edward Creasy, published 1851, Episode 3. And today we're talking about the battle that decided whether Rome would rule the world, or whether two sons of a man called the Thunderbolt would burn it to the ground.
At the end, we vote, keep or cut. Scoreboard stands at 4-4. Marathon, Syracuse, and Arbella all stayed. Let's see if the Metaurus earns its place.
Oh, and a quick note. The Roman general who won this battle, his name is Nero. Not that Nero.
Claudius Nero the consul, 400 years before the fiddle-playing emperor. Byron, Lord Byron, actually had to clarify this in the poem that opens the chapter. He wrote, "The infamy of the one has eclipsed the glory of the other. When the name of Nero is heard, who thinks of the consul? But such are human things."
Poor consul Nero. He saved Rome, and then a distant relative burned it down and ruined the family name forever.
It's like if your great-great-great-grandson became history's most famous arsonist. You'd want to rebrand.
Okay, so bridge from last episode. We left off with Alexander the Great conquering everything in sight. Arbella, 331 BC. The whole known world speaking Greek within a generation.
And now we jump forward 124 years to 207 BC, and the world has changed completely. Alexander's empire has splintered, the Greek kingdoms are fighting each other, and two new powers have risen in the Western Mediterranean, Rome and Carthage.
And they've been at each other's throats for decades. The First Punic War ended in 241 BC. Rome won, took Sicily, Carthage was humiliated. And a Carthaginian general named Hamilcar Barca, whose surname means the Thunderbolt.
Creasy actually notes that. Hamilcar was surnamed Barca, which means the Thunderbolt.
This man swore that his sons would avenge the defeat. He had three boys. He trained them as, Creasy puts it, like three lion's whelps to prey upon the Romans.
Three lion cubs raised on a diet of pure revenge. That's not parenting. That's a military program.
The oldest was Hannibal. The middle was Hasdrubal. The youngest was Mago. And Hannibal, at the age of 9, swore an oath at his father's altar that he would never be a friend to Rome.
And he kept it for the rest of his life.
So, 218 BC, Hannibal does the impossible. He crosses the Alps with an army. And 37 elephants.
37 elephants over the Alps in winter, which is insane. And also, most of them died. All of them, actually, except one.
One elephant survived. His name was Cyrus, the Syrian.
Cyrus, possibly the last Syrian elephant ever used in warfare. Hannibal rode Cyrus through the marshes of the Arno the following spring, with one eye, because Hannibal had lost the sight in his right eye to a swamp infection during that crossing.
Wait, the CDC actually published a paper on this? 2021, the CDC journal Emerging Infectious Diseases, Hannibal's Ophthalmia, a New Answer to an Ancient Question. They analyzed possible pathogens from first century marshland conditions. The Centers for Disease Control wrote a peer-reviewed paper about an eye infection from 217 BC.
I love that this exists.
So picture this. a one-eyed general riding the last surviving elephant from his alpine crossing, leading an army of Spaniards, Africans, Gauls, and Numidians through Italy. And he's winning. He is winning everything.
Trebia, 218 BC, victory. Lake Trasimene, 217, victory. He ambushes an entire Roman army in the fog. And then Cannae, 216, the greatest tactical victory in ancient history. 50,000 Romans dead in a single afternoon.
And after Cannae, the Romans just don't quit.
They don't. And this is the part that Creasy loves. He quotes Thomas Arnold. Twice has there been witnessed the struggle of the highest individual genius against the resources and institutions of a great nation. And in both cases, the nation has been victorious. For 17 years, Hannibal strove against Rome. For 16 years, Napoleon Bonaparte strove against England. The efforts of the first ended in Zama, those of the second in Waterloo. And that's a genuinely great parallel. One genius against an entire system, and the system wins both times.
But here's what makes Hannibal's story uniquely tragic. After Cannae, after the greatest victory any general had ever won, his own government wouldn't send him reinforcements.
Think about that. He's in Italy. He's beaten the Romans 3 times in 3 years. He's destroyed their best armies. And Carthage says, nah, we're good. You figure it out.
There was a faction in the Carthaginian Senate that was actively hostile to the Barca family. They didn't want Hannibal to get too successful. They preferred to keep their trade routes and their money rather than back the war effort.
So Hannibal is stuck in Italy for 11 years. He can win battles, but he can't win the war. He can't take Rome without siege equipment. He can't get siege equipment without reinforcements. He can't get reinforcements because his own government won't send them.
That's not an invasion. That's a very aggressive Airbnb guest who won't leave.
11 years. He just moved in and Rome couldn't evict him.
And Creasy captures this perfectly with his deerhound metaphor. Sam, read it.
You read it. It's your favorite.
The single deerhound could not pull down the quarry which he had so furiously assailed. Rome not only stood fiercely at bay, but had pressed back and gored her antagonist, that still, however, watched her in act to spring. She was weary and bleeding at every pore, and there seemed to be little hope of her escape if the other hound of old Hamilcar's race should come up in time to aid his brother in the death grapple.
Hannibal is the first hound. Hasdrubal is the second. Rome is the stack. And the whole battle of the Metaurus is about whether the second hound arrives in time.
It's a great metaphor. Except the stag fights back. The stag has 15 legions.
This is a very Roman stag.
Okay, so spring of 207 BC, Hasdrubal, the middle brother, the second lion cub, has finally crossed the Alps with his own army. Spaniards, Africans, Ligurians, and 10 elephants.
Not 37, 10. He learned from his brother's mistakes. Or maybe he just ran out of elephants. And Creasy says something remarkable about the crossing. Unlike Hannibal, who'd fought the mountain tribes the whole way, Hasdrubal crossed easily. The Alpine peoples had heard about the war raging in Italy for 11 years. They knew this army wasn't coming for them. Some of them even joined up. Creasy describes him descending from the Alps, like a rolling snowball, far greater than he came over the Pyrenees at his first setting out of Spain.
A rolling snowball. That's a great image. And also terrifying if you're Rome.
And now Rome has a problem. Hannibal in the south with his veteran army. Hasdrubal in the north with a growing army. If they link up, game over. Two sons of the Thunderbolt, converging on Rome from both directions.
So the Romans mobilize everything. 6 armies, 70,000 Roman citizens in 15 legions, plus an equal number of Italian allies. And Creasy gives us a number that tells you how desperate things were. The total Roman male population of military age had fallen from 270,000 before the war to barely 130,000.
They'd lost half their men in 12 years.
And now, the intercepted letter. This is the hinge of the entire war. Hasdrubal sends messengers to Hannibal. The letter lays out the whole plan. They should unite in Southumbria and then wheel round against Rome together.
Those messengers traverse the greater part of Italy in safety, but when close to the object of their mission, were captured by a Roman detachment, and Hasdrubal's letter, detailing his whole plan of the campaign, was laid not in his brother's hands, but in those of the commander of the Roman armies of the south.
Pre-internet phishing attack. Hasdrubal just sent his entire battle plan in plain text, and Rome intercepted it.
No encryption, no code words, just
Dear brother, here's exactly where I'll be and what I'm doing. Please meet me there.
And the man who intercepted it was Claudius Nero, the good Nero, not the fiddle Nero.
We should start a support group for him. People named Nero whose achievements were overshadowed by a distant relative.
So Nero reads the letter and instantly sees the opportunity. If Hasdrubal and Hannibal join forces, Rome is finished. But if Nero can get north and destroy Hasdrubal before Hannibal even knows what's happening,
then the second hound dies, and the first hound is alone forever.
Nero takes 7,000 picked men, 6,000 infantry, 1,000 cavalry, and marches north, in secret, at night, leaving the rest of his army to keep up the pretense that he's still in camp opposite Hannibal.
250 miles in 6 or 7 days, 35 miles a day, in full armor, in Italian summer heat.
And the whole country helps. Creasy's description of the march is one of the best passages in the book. Their whole path was amidst the vows and prayers and praises of their countrymen. The entire population of the districts through which they passed flocked to the roadside to see and bless the deliverers of their country. Food, drink, and refreshments of every kind were eagerly pressed on their acceptance.
It's like a 250-mile standing ovation.
Soldiers sleeping in wagons that farmers brought to the road. Fresh volunteers joining every mile. Veterans from previous campaigns stepping out of retirement to march with them. And Nero tells his men, this is what he says, "The officer who is forgiving time for my men here to rest themselves is forgiving time to Hannibal to attack my men, who I have left in the camp in Apulia. He is forgiving time to Hannibal and Hasdrubal to discover my march and to maneuver for a junction with each other in Cisalpine Gaul at their leisure. We must fight instantly."
We must fight instantly. No rust, no delay. Every hour matters.
And he arrives at night, slips his 7,000 men into the camp of the other consul, Livius, without expanding the camp. Every man is billeted with a comrade. No new tents, no signs that the Roman army has just doubled in size.
That's operational security that would impress a modern special forces commander.
But Hasdrubal is not stupid. When the Romans march out the next morning, he notices things. The horses look rough, like they've been force-marched. Some of the armor is unusually dull and stained. And then, this detail kills me. The trumpet which gave the signal to the Roman legions sounded that morning once oftener than usual, as if directing the troops of some additional superior officer.
One extra trumpet blast. That's all it took. Hasdrubal heard one extra trumpet and knew a second consul had arrived.
From his campaigns in Spain, he knew exactly what Roman military signals meant. One blast too many, two consuls instead of one. He orders a retreat north towards the Metaurus River.
And here's where it falls apart. His guides betray him. They lead him to an unfordable section of the river. His Gallic troops, drunk. His men are wandering along the banks in confusion. And when dawn comes, the Roman cavalry is already on his tail.
Hasdrubal has no choice. He can't cross, he can't retreat. He draws up his men and fights.
And the battle itself, Creasy pulls from Sir Walter Raleigh's account, which is vivid. The Spaniards and Africans on Hasdrubal's right are fighting hard. Livius is getting hammered. The Ligurians in the center are holding. The elephants are causing chaos, breaking Roman formations, forcing the standards to fall back.
And on the other side, Nero can't even reach the Gauls on Hasdrubal's left wing because the ground is too steep and rugged.
So Nero does the thing that makes him a genius. The same kind of move he made with the march itself. He doesn't sit there pushing against a hill. He pulls his men out, wheels them around the entire back of the Roman army, and slams into the flank of Hasdrubal's Spaniards.
From behind, while they're locked in combat with Livius, they never see it coming.
The Spaniards and Africans are rolled up. The Ligurians are overwhelmed. The Gauls, who were drunk and hadn't really fought all day, are surrounded and butchered.
And Hasdrubal. Creasy writes his death scene with genuine admiration. Hasdrubal, after having, by the confession of his enemies, done all that a general could do, when he saw that the victory was irreparably lost, scorning to survive the gallant host which he had led, and to gratify, as a captive, Roman cruelty and pride, spurred his horse into the midst of a Roman cohort, where, sword in hand, he met the death that was worthy of the son of Hamilcar and the brother of Hannibal.
The death that was worthy of the son of Hamilcar and the brother of Hannibal. Creasy, a man writing from Rome's perspective, gives the Carthaginian enemy a hero's exit.
He could have dismissed him. He could have said, the barbarian general fell. But he calls it worthy. That's good writing. Dead author earned that line.
And then Nero marches back south, 250 miles, and he's back in his camp facing Hannibal before Hannibal even knows he left.
That's the part that got Byron. Byron called it the unequaled march. And when you think about it, Nero marched 500 miles, fought a battle, and returned, all while his enemy had no idea he was gone, in the ancient world, on foot. And then they threw the head. Okay, fact checker hats on. Where does Creasy get it right, and where does he get it wrong?
Let's start with what he gets right, because honestly, this is one of his better chapters.
Really?
The core facts are solid. Nero's march, confirmed by modern scholarship, about 250 Roman miles in 6 or 7 days, 7,000 picked men, the intercepted letter, the night arrival at Livius's camp, the flanking maneuver, Hasdrubal's heroic death, all confirmed in both Livy and Polybius.
Army numbers?
Creasy is actually careful here. He says he has no trustworthy information about Hasdrubal's infantry numbers. Modern estimates put Hasdrubal's total force around 30,000, 20,000 crossing the Alps, swelling to 30,000 with Gallic recruits. The combined Roman force at the battle was probably 40 to 47,000. Creasy says Hasdrubal was greatly outnumbered, and that's confirmed.
What about this Scipio-Wellington parallel? Because that took up a lot of the chapter.
That's actually one of Creasy's sharpest observations. He draws a detailed comparison. Scipio and Wellington both commanded in Spain for years. Both defeated subordinate generals before facing the main enemy. Both eventually delivered the decisive blow that ended the war. Both became political leaders afterward. Both were treated badly by the public they'd saved. It's a strong parallel, and modern historians have echoed it.
So what does he get wrong?
The big one is the racial framing. And this is the most dated passage in the entire book so far.
The Michelet quote?
He quotes the French historian Michelet at enormous length. And Michelet's argument is that the Punic Wars were a civilizational clash between, and I'm quoting, the Indo-Germanic or the Semitic family of nations. He divides the entire human race into two categories. On one side is the genius of heroism, of art, and legislation. On the other is the spirit of industry, of commerce, of navigation.
Indo-Germanic versus Semitic. And he's saying the Punic Wars were a racial struggle.
And Creasy doesn't just quote it, he uses it as his analytical framework. The whole chapter is structured around this idea that Rome's victory was a victory for the Indo-Germanic race over the Semitic race. That's not history. That's 19th century racial pseudoscience dressed up as scholarship.
And to be clear, modern scholarship completely rejects this framework.
Completely. The idea that Greeks, Romans, and Germans form one race, opposed to Jews, Arabs, and Phoenicians as another race, that's a Victorian construction that was used to justify colonial hierarchies for the next 100 years. It has no basis in genetics, anthropology, or serious historical analysis. The Punic Wars were a geopolitical struggle between two Mediterranean powers, full stop.
Though it's worth noting, Creasy doesn't invent this framework. He inherits it from Michelet and from the broader intellectual climate of the 1850s.
True, but he amplifies it. He gives it 3 full paragraphs, and he never pushes back on it the way he pushes back on Livy's fabricated Roman victories. He knows Livy is lying about battle statistics, but he doesn't know Michelet is selling racial fantasy. That's his blind spot, and it's the blind spot of his entire generation.
Now, the salt myth, because I know people are waiting for this.
Every time someone talks about Roman Carthage, someone brings up, and then the Romans salted the earth at Carthage so nothing would ever grow again.
Did they?
No. Zero ancient evidence. None. Not in Appian, who gives the most detailed account of Carthage's destruction in 146 BC. Not in Polybius. Not in any surviving Roman source. The myth first appears around 1863, nearly 2,000 years after the event.
1863? That's 12 years after Creasy published this book.
Right. And Creasy, to his credit, doesn't mention salting the earth because the myth didn't exist yet when he was writing.
So where did it come from?
Probably modeled on the biblical story of Abimelech salting Shechem in the Book of Judges. And it makes no practical sense anyway. Salt was expensive and Rome needed the farmland. They refounded Carthage as a Roman colony under Augusta, and it became one of the most productive agricultural regions in the entire empire. You don't salt the earth and then farm it.
So the most famous fact about Roman Carthage is completely made up.
The myth is itself a kind of historical salt. It has poisoned countless textbooks with a falsehood. And I guarantee someone listening right now is realizing they learned it in school and it was never true.
We're going to get emails about that.
Now, a more serious historical question, Metaurus versus Zama. Is Creasy right that Metaurus was the real turning point?
Because the war didn't end at the Metaurus. It ended 5 years later at Zama in 202 BC, when Scipio defeated Hannibal in Africa.
Right. And Creasy explicitly argues that Metaurus was the determining crisis of the contest. He says Scipio trampled in the dust the power of Carthage at Zama, but that power had been already irreparably shattered in another field.
So Metaurus killed the hope. Zama killed the army.
And modern historians largely agree. An academic paper on academia.edu is literally titled Metaurus, the Most Important Battle of the Second Punic War. The argument is that after Metaurus, Hannibal could never win. The best he could do was survive. And a war where your best outcome is survival is a war you've already lost.
Adrian Goldsworthy goes even further. He argues Hannibal's campaign was strategically unsustainable from the moment Carthage failed to reinforce him after Cannae. Metaurus confirmed what was already probable.
Which actually makes Hannibal more tragic, not less. He fought for 17 years in a war his own government had already given up on. He just didn't know it yet.
Now, I have to ask about the elephant, the one Creasy mentioned. Hasdrubal brought 10 elephants to the Metaurus, right? But what happened to Hannibal's original elephants?
All dead. 37 crossed the Alps. Most survived and fought at the Battle of Trivia. But the winter of 218 BC was brutal. An ice storm killed all of them except Cyrus, the Syrian. And Cyrus survived the winter, carried Hannibal through the Arno Marshes, where Hannibal lost his eye, and then disappeared from the historical record. Nobody knows what happened to him.
So, the last elephant carrying a one-eyed general through a swamp? That's the saddest war story I've ever heard.
And when Hannibal finally fought at Zama 15 years later, he had 80 new elephants, African ones, obtained locally, none of the original 37. They've been gone for over a decade.
One more thing. Creasy has this amazing detail about how Rome reacted when the news of victory arrived. Do you want to tell it or should I?
You do it. It's classic Sam material.
Okay, so Rome has been in agony. They know the armies are facing each other. They know everything depends on this one battle. And at first, a rumor spreads. Two horsemen from Narnia.
Not that Narnia.
Not that Narnia. The Italian town of Narnia. Two horsemen ride in with news that the enemy has been utterly destroyed. But people can't believe it. It's too good. They think it might be a trick or a forgery or a trap. And then official dispatches arrive from the consuls themselves. And three officers ride into Rome. And as they make their way through the crowd, this fast, living sea of people, each person they pass turns around and becomes the center of their own group, repeating the news.
Like a viral tweet spreading through a human network, except slower and with more crying.
And Creasy says the whole city erupted. 3 days of Thanksgiving, temples packed, women in their finest clothes with their children, offering prayers of gratitude. Commerce resumed, traffic started flowing again. People bought and sold and made plans. He says, a numbing load was taken off each heart and brain.
A numbing load was taken off each heart and brain. That's a line you'd expect from a novelist, not a professor.
Dead author had his moments.
Oh, before we get to the verdict, pop culture check. Has anyone made a movie about the Metaurus?
Nobody. Zero films. The most dramatic scene in the Second Punic War, the severed head, the groan, the march, and no one has put it on screen.
The BBC made a 90-minute Hannibal film in 2006, Alexander Siddig as Hannibal, 6.7 on IMDb, but it's a general overview, not focused on the Taurus.
And here's the exciting one. There's a Hannibal film coming, Denzel Washington, directed by Antoine Fuqua, written by John Logan, the guy who wrote Gladiator and The Aviator, Netflix, filming in Italy summer 2026.
Denzel as Hannibal. If they don't include the severed head scene, what are we even doing?
That's the Oscar clip right there. Denzel picking up a head and groaning. And if you're a gamer, Total War Rome 2 has a Hannibal at the Gates DLC, 2014. You can play the entire Second Punic War. The Metaurus isn't a standalone historical battle, but it can happen in the campaign. Base game scored a 76 on Metacritic.
The original Rome Total War from 2004 also has Carthage as a playable faction. You can fight the Battle of Lake Trasimene as a historical scenario. But nobody has made a game specifically about Nero's march. And honestly, a stealth strategy game where you have to march an army 500 miles without being detected, that's a better game than most things on Steam right now.
Someone make that. Okay. Scoreboard time. Creasy's claim.
The Battle of the Metaurus is a decisive battle that changed the course of civilization. His argument, if Hasdrubal had reached Hannibal, the two brothers would have overwhelmed Rome. Carthage would have become the dominant power. Latin wouldn't be the foundation of European languages. Roman law, Roman roads, Roman engineering, none of it. Christianity would have had no Roman infrastructure to spread through.
And he goes further. He quotes Arnold on the question of whether Carthage could replace Rome. And Arnold's argument is devastating. No one man, even though it were Hannibal himself, can in one generation effect such a work. But where the nation has been merely enkindled for a while by a great man's spirit, the light passes away with him who communicated it, and the nation, when he is gone, is like a dead body to which magic power had for a moment given unnatural life.
Ouch. Arnold is saying even if Hannibal had won, Carthage couldn't have built what Rome built, because Carthage was one man's war. Rome was a nation's war.
And that's Creasy's strongest point. The Senate that voted thanks to their general Varro after a catastrophic defeat at Cannae because he had not despaired of the Commonwealth, that's not one man's spirit. That's institutional resilience. Carthage didn't have that.
My vote first?
Go.
Keep. And I'll tell you why. Not just because the battle itself is dramatic, though it is. The intercepted letter, the secret march, the one extra trumpet blast, the flanking maneuver, the severed head. It's a thriller plot. But beyond the drama, Creasy's argument holds up. After Metaurus, Hannibal couldn't win. He stayed in Italy for 4 more years, but he was finished. The second hound was dead. And without the second hound, the deerhound could never bring down the quarry. Creasy compares Nero's march to Marlborough's march to Blenheim. Byron calls it unequaled. Modern military historians agree it was the finest strategic feat of the entire war. It stays.
Keep. With a flag, but a smaller flag than usual. The racial framing is garbage. Michelet's Indo-Germanic versus Semitic framework is pseudoscience, and Creasy should have known better. But underneath that framework, the historical analysis is strong. Creasy is honest about his sources. He flags Livy's fabrications, he cites Polybius, he admits where the numbers are uncertain. He treats Hasdrubal's death with genuine dignity. He condemns Rome's brutality with the severed head. And his central claim that Metaurus, not Sama, was the real turning point is supported by modern scholarship.
Plus, he gives us the single best metaphor in the entire book, the deerhound and the wolf pack.
It's a great image. Hannibal, the lone predator, Rome, the wounded quarry, Hasdrubal, the reinforcement that never arrived. Strip away the Victorian racism and you've got a genuinely sharp piece of military analysis.
That's 5 for 5 on the season. We still haven't cut anything.
We're getting soft. We need to cut something soon or we'll lose all credibility.
Don't worry. There are 10 more chapters. We'll find one.
And speaking of which, episode 4, The Teutoburg Forest, 9 AD. 3 Roman legions, 15,000 men, march into the forests of Germania. Their guide is a man named Arminius, a Germanic chief, who also happens to be a Roman citizen, a Roman officer, and a personal friend of the Roman commander.
He's a double agent. The Romans trained him, gave him citizenship, gave him a command, and he used everything they taught him to lead 3 legions into the deepest forest in Europe and destroy them all.
When the Roman Emperor Augustus heard the news, he allegedly wandered his palace for months, banging his head against the walls and crying out, "Varus, give me back my legions."
Arminius and the Teutoburg Forest.
Next time on the Dead Authors Club. We read books by dead authors, so you don't have to.
Occidit, occidit. Perished, perished.